The Education Gadfly Show starts now.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, who Al Gore thanked in his Oscar acceptance speech, Rick Hess. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you, Mike. He did.
Did you catch that part of it?
I did not. Maybe I didn't. Maybe I snoozed. What did he say?
Yeah, I want to ask, when did Al Gore get fat? And am I the last person in the world to know that
he's no longer fat? He was really fat like in 01 and 02, and he's teaching at Columbia. Remember with the beard and the puffy?
Well, right. Was that you couldn't see it because of the beard?
Well, he's just chubs up and down, but now he's – I think he looks kind of polished. He glows.
He glows. Well, speaking of chubbiness, though, here as we sit recording this very podcast, I understand that Congressman Zach Womp from Tennessee, a Republican, and fitness guru Richard Simmons are calling for PE to be included in No Child Left Behind.
Thank heavens. And not only are they calling it to be included, but they're going to outbid both the bipartisan commission administration. They want 100% proficiency in – you know, athletics by 2011.
Really? Wait. Proficiency in athletics? I mean, is that...
Well, what else are you going
to
do?
What is it? You have to be able to do 10 chin-ups or what is this?
Mike, 10 chin-ups? No, we want proficiency. Every child in this country by 2011 needs to be able to run 10 miles in 98 minutes in combat boots, mm-hmm. do 90 sit-ups in 2 minutes,
okay.
and do at least 25 flexed arm hangs. And we want it disaggregated by subgroup. None of this stuff for weak, legless, or fat kids are going to have lower standards than other kids. By God, there need to be uniform, universal expectations for kids.
Wow. Well, you are on board with Congressman Womp.
And Simmons. I think, you know, and I hope in, you know, Fordham's relentless push
Womp.
to not allow the curriculum to be unduly narrowed,
Womp.
That you guys are going to get on board, baby.
Well, hey, you know, if it's a national standard, we are in favor of it. All right. Well, listeners, if you have any other harebrained ideas for No Child Left Behind's reauthorization, send us a note at letters@edexcellence.net. Okay, let's get going. We will, of course, start with our game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then we have an interview with an actual professional journalist today. and somebody who attended seminary and now wrote about the Catholic schools. And finally, Kobe sitting in for Liam, who is at home sick.
Liam. What kind of game is that, huh?
It's supposed to be – where's your empathy, sympathy?
I thought Liam was a pro.
He was not feeling well.
He's Liam – the news of the weird guy, and here it is, news of the weird, and he's, sick, well, I got a bellyache.
Well, you know, this is Kobe's big chance to shine, so.
How did Kobe do last time? Did he do good?
He did good. So he is going to serve up a dose of education news of the weird.
You know, Liam could be going through what Wally Pipp went through.
What's that?
Remember Wally Pipp?
I have no idea.
He was a guy who lost his job to Lou Gehrig one day, had a little bellyache, sat out 14 years or something before Lou Gehrig was out of there. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Liam, if you're listening at home, be very afraid. All right, Jen, let's get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
All right. Topic one. The newest data from the National Assessment of Educational Progress shows that American students' GPAs are a notch up from 1990. Unfortunately, it also shows a drop in the percentage of 12th graders able to read at a basic level, and this despite 360 more hours of instructional time per year than in 1990. Mike, please deconstruct this troubling paradox.
Well, it's even more confusing because we also found out that more students are taking challenging courses than ever before. So instead of taking business math, they're now taking Algebra 2 and so forth. So what does this mean? I mean, most people say, look, this must mean that these course descriptions don't mean anything. Kids are signing up for more courses and taking more size. You know, but you have no way of knowing without standards, much less national standards, you have no way of knowing whether these courses are actually maintaining their rigor. So sure, you can change the titles of the courses. The kids can sign up for harder stuff, you know, but it's just meaningless.
I mean, partly this is, you know, this is a school reform game of whack-a-mole we play. So we want to get kids in more advanced classes, so we insist that all kids take these classes.
Right.
We see the same thing, say, with the Newsweek AP Index, pressure to get kids into classes. But the inevitable reality is that a lot of these kids actually aren't well-suited to these classes, aren't doing well in them, haven't been adequately prepared. So what do teachers do? They reduce expectations. They cover less material. I mean, none of this should be surprising. So then we have to turn around and fix that by we demand more rigor, and then more of these kids fail, and then we worry that these kids are in the wrong classes, so we shift them out. And it's an endless cycle. I mean, it creates a lot of white papers and a lot of, you know, yabby, yabby, yabba among the policy types. But, you know, part of the problem here is just this fundamental unwillingness to tangle with reality when we deal with reform.
But it's, you know, but it's not just about the students. It's also about the teachers, right? I mean, the only way you're going to make this work is to have teachers who are prepared, lots more teachers who are prepared to teach these tough courses.
Yes, but this is yet one more piece of evidence that, you know, 2001 marked a dramatic turning point and everything is well on the way to 2014, baby.
That's right. Hey, we're going to have that dramatic uptick here at the end.
It's
okay, Jen, number two.
All right, topic two. Fed up with the school board's reluctance to ban books portraying Cuba in a positive light, a Miami mother has done so herself. She went to her son's school library, checked the books out, and is refusing to return them. Dalila Rodriguez, a member of the Concerned Cuban Parents Committee, said she's going to, quote, take the books and lock them in a box. They're leaving us in legal limbo, so we're leaving them in limbo too. What do you think, Rick? Is this a fair form of nonviolent protest?
I mean, I got to say, I sympathize with Ms. Rodriguez, but her beef seems to be with the Cuban people. So why she is ripping off Florida's taxpayers, I'm a little confused. I'm not sure she understands who pays for and who funds books that show up in Floridian libraries.
Actually, Rick, she might not really be ripping off taxpayers because they are charging her 5 cents a day for each day that she doesn't return the book.
Oof. So a stiff fine. Stiff.
Well, I think librarians across the country should be concerned that if this form of nonviolent protest catches on, all of a sudden their shelves are going to be barren of books like Charles Darwin, The Origin of Species. You imagine all the creationists borrowing that book and never returning it,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, anything at all about sex education or –
Sure. And on the
know,
other
Heather
side,
has
you
two
can
mommies.
Imagine progressives, Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh books.
Mm-hmm.
I mean – Right. I mean, if it's acceptable because we disagree with a book, that we are going to take it, hide it, suffer our massive 5 cent a day fine, and you know, which nobody, of course, I don't know anybody in the history of the world has ever paid a library fine. This seems like a particularly unattractive direction to take library services.
Okay. Topic number.
I'm a little slow today. Sorry.
I don't know, Mike. I like your slippery slope there. That's a evocative image.
Well, I just think it's a real problem. I mean, because frankly, I don't know why the creationists haven't figured this out before.
Especially, you know, if you could justify yourself with crappy rationalizations like
right?
They're leaving us in legal limbo, so we're leaving them in limbo too. One, I'm not sure who the us is.
Right.
Two, I think it refers to them being the Cuban government. So I'm not sure how stealing books from Florida's libraries is having any effect whatsoever on the Cuban government.
The limbo is that the school board had considered banning the book or actually tried to, but then the ACLU sued and so they didn't anymore. So that's the legal limbo.
So who's the them in this case?
I don't know that.
I'm so confused.
I think that's just a philosophical question you're asking, Rick. Chen.
All right.
Please give us the third topic.
Final topic. Today, the Center for American Progress and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce released a report that bears a striking resemblance to the Fordham Report 2006. Leaders and Laggards, co-authored by our very own Rick Hess, grades and ranks the states on 9 indicators, 5 of which appeared in the Fordham Report in one form or another. Mike, what is new in this report?
Well, you know, first of all, let us point out that this was by two organizations, prominent organizations, and Frederick M. Hess. That was very impressive, Rick. The Frederick M. Hess Institution. So it's a good report. It's helpful. Another good state report card. And very prominent organizations, especially the Chamber of Commerce, which is why I don't understand the press strategy here, Rick. I mean, as far as I could tell, there was barely a press release. There was, you know, you didn't have an overall grade for the states. So, you know, it was hard to be able to give a headline, you know, to a reporter. Texas gets an F or gets an A or what? I don't know. Much less information that local reporters can use. I mean, this should have been huge news all over the country. Chamber of Commerce grades the states, tells some states they have a lousy education system. Just not sure you're going to get the coverage you deserve.
Yeah, you know, that's fortunately it's not my department. In fact, I specialize in trying to write incendiary work, which
All right.
then Let
me ask you, though, about one indicator. So one new thing in here was this return on investment. So you tried to look at states that had high achievement but low spending. So states like Utah did very well. Now, but doesn't that just mean because, you know, Utah doesn't have as many poor kids as other states?
So that indicator, we did control for the percentage of kids in the state who are disadvantaged for special needs population and for cost of living.
But did you control for the number of students who are Mormon?
Unfortunately, we did not.
Mm-hmm.
And and it is that famed Mormon predictor.
Yeah. See, I think the kids in Utah have these huge families. They're going home and with their other siblings, and they're learning a lot from their older peers. And that is why they're doing so well in school.
You know what it is? It's also because you got to do that BYOB to your, you know, to Salt Lake City bars.
Right.
And which makes it a whole lot more or less attractive to try to sneak in.
Sneak out into bars. I guess less attractive. I don't know.
It's kind of an interesting.
Yeah, I think we got to do a study on Mormons and education.
Hmm.
Mormons do it right. We should follow up on that.
Big love. I could be a new Fordham report. Big love. Mormons do it right.
That is it for Pardon the Gadfly. Now we turn to our interview this week with Peter Meyer, who wrote a great piece on Catholic Schools for Education Next. Let's take a listen. We're talking today with Peter Meyer, who's a contributing editor at the journal Education Next, about his brand new article, Can Catholic Schools Be Saved? Peter, welcome to the Education Gadfly Show.
Good to be here, Mike.
So, Peter, this is a fascinating article. You look at some of the problems that are plaguing Catholic schools and also some possible solutions to help them come alive again. I understand from your own background that you have a strong connection to Catholic education. Can you describe that a bit?
Well, I was, as I say in my lead of the piece, this is I've been writing this piece in my head for about 10 years, ever since I stood outside our little local public school with a friend of mine, and he turned to me and said, nothing wrong with this place that a busload of nuns wouldn't fix.
Right.
And we both knew, we both laughed because we both grew up Catholic and knew exactly what he meant. I grew up Catholic in the 50s when Catholic schools were probably at their peak, actually. In 1960, I think they educated one out of every eight children in the United States.
So that's amazing. And then
Catholic and went to a Catholic seminary.
That's right. You went to a seminary itself. That's right. So you were well on your way. But in fact, you decided not to become a priest, huh?
I did.
Okay, a writer instead. Okay, good. Well, when you look at this topic, Peter, what do you think are some of the major reasons we've seen this dramatic decline in the number of students attending inner-city Catholic schools?
Well, there's no question that the huge change in the church and Catholic schools is the loss of nuns. I mean, there's not only, you know, you can't find a busload of nuns, but you can't find a minivan worth of nuns these days.
Right.
The Catholic school system at its peak, I think, probably was 90%, high 90% taught by nuns who were practically free labor at the time, and that has completely changed. So the Catholic schools now are almost predominantly taught, teachers and administrators are lay people, and you have to pay them. So it's created a huge financial crisis for Catholic schools.
Okay, so suddenly Catholic schools are much more expensive than they used to be because they have to pay teachers a decent salary because they don't have that free labor. Now, some people would argue, though, that you know there's been plenty of private Christian schools that have sprung up that are also charging low tuitions that have been maybe more entrepreneurial. I mean, is the Catholic Church doing all it can?
Well, clearly, the church, Catholic Church, has lost a great deal of momentum in the education field, but they're hardly down and out. They still are educating, you know, something like over 2 million children in roughly 7,000 schools. So, and they're working very diligently with all kinds of new sort of organizational schemes to sort of get themselves back in the mainstream of the educational, you know, the private school educational market.
So then let's answer your question in the article. Can the Catholic schools be saved, particularly inner-city Catholic schools? Is there any hope, or is this just an irreversible decline in urban Catholic education?
No, I mean, I don't think it's irreversible by any means. And in fact, as I've already heard from a Notre Dame scholar who told me that the piece is a little too doomy and gloomy. That lots of great things are going on in the Catholic Church and the Catholic school system. Some of which I mentioned in the piece. Inner city schools are consolidating. They're sharing resources. They're doing major fundraising campaigns. Memphis, especially. I told the story of Memphis because that's a real phenomenal sort of success story, and it sort of points the way for other school systems. And that's when a group of still anonymous donors gave millions of dollars to the diocese of Memphis to open, reopen, closed Catholic schools in the Memphis inner city. And the donors were not Catholic, and most of the kids that are now going to these reopened schools are not Catholic either.
So people, though, still see the value in a Catholic education, after all. Long before there was KIPP, there were Catholic schools doing a great job educating poor kids. You know, right. I know Diane Ravitch has made the case that if only Bill Gates would put just a bit of his largesse into saving urban Catholic education, he'd probably do a lot more good than supporting all these new small public schools.
Well, the one thing that we've known, the research, lots of people have known for years, but the research started with James Coleman, obviously, in the 80s. The one thing we know is that Catholic schools really do a remarkable job of educating kids, especially low-income and minority kids, and they do a much better job of that than public schools. So the Catholics have always been doing something right, and it seems to me that they definitely can be saved if they get their demographic and financial act together, because the educational act has been together and still seems to be together.
Okay, well, there you have it. And of course, as you ask in your article, can Catholic schools be saved even without that busload of nuns? We will find out. Peter Meyer, thanks for joining us on the Education Gadfly Show. Hope you'll come back sometime.
Thanks, Mike.
So, Rick, Peter was in the seminary once upon a time. Did you ever think about becoming a rabbi?
You know, I did. I applied when I was 14, but I was rejected. You had to do the whole Jerry curl action, and my hair doesn't look good like that. You know, Peter's a stud. Many people may not know that Peter Meyer, for about 2 years, was the story editor for Education Next,
right?
The successor to the famed Tice Palmafi. So, nice job with the article, Peter.
Very nice job. Okay, it is time for everybody's favorite education news of the weird. Of course, Kobe, as we said before, is filling in for the bedridden Liam Julian. So, Kobe, what is weird this week?
Mike, news is slow on the indecent use of body parts front, which I know is Liam's favorite, but luckily teachers are still finding ways to embarrass themselves. Take Jeremy Bayliss, a 12th grade teacher in Port Elizabeth, South Africa, whose expletive-laced tirade recently landed him on YouTube. In the video, which a quick-thinking student captured on his cell phone, Bayliss calls his pupils, quote, rude, expletive omitted, animals, quote, bloody bastards with a, expletive omitted, lack of manners, and, quote, the rudest pigs I've ever come across.
That's classy. I like that.
End quote. He then tells them, quote, if you want to tell your parents, get them on the phone to me. You're bloody rubbish. End quote.
Rubbish. I like rubbish.
Bayliss then storms out of the room and slams the door behind him as a student is heard asking, quote, can you Bluetooth that to me? End quote. And Bluetooth it, his classmate did. To date, the clip has been viewed over 20,000 times. Neil Crawford, the rector of Gray High School, said Bayliss had been, quote, dealt with internally, end quote. He also banned cell phones from the school. Rick, did you ever swear in the classroom?
As teacher or as student?
This was a teacher.
Yes. Well, I think I swore more when I was a kid than when I was a teacher. But yeah, I still did. Thank God they didn't have cell phones back in the day. You know, but, you know, and especially, you know, it's like the South Africans, those guys are like the Brits. They do it with such class. You know, you're bloody rubbish. That's just so there. Can't you see like Helen Mirren's doing that in The Queen?
Yeah. I mean, you know, every teacher, I'm sure, has wanted to say that at one point or another.
Oh, my God.
But this, you know, this cell phone thing is interesting. I think pretty soon we're just going to have cameras in every classroom. And parents at home or at work are going to be able to log on to the internet and just check in. See how things are going. You know, speaking of this, there was a big incident here in D.C. yesterday where a parent came in and had their child strip in front of their classmates so that she could hit him with a belt
And the teacher let this all go on.
Huh. That would be serious YouTube.
And tried to say that nothing was wrong with this, but everybody, please don't tell your parents.
You know, well, it's funny. Once they figure out how to monetize YouTube, too, schools could actually make some serious money off of that kind of stuff.
Well, not off the – you mean off teachers acting poorly.
Well, off the teacher – off the parent coming in and stripping her kid and stuff? Forget about it.
We don't want to – as long as we're actually showing the kid.
Why not? You could do the little pixelation like they do like on the pictures of
Rick,
the American Idol gal getting busy.
Oh, I see. All right. So you're going to block it out.
So you pixelate the face. Have you seen the pictures of the American Idol gal getting busy?
No.
Well,
I don't frequent those websites.
How? They're not hard to frequent. They jump out at you from Yahoo, for heaven's sake. But all I'm saying – for instance, I mean, I remember one time when I was when I was teaching in Baton Rouge, and one of my kids stole another teacher's Lexus and wrapped it around a telephone pole. And, you know, I mean, that kid, the kid was bloody rubbish, and she was pretty ticked. She was a nice enough lady, and, you know, I'm sure she was disappointed about having her car ruined. But, you know, the other thing here is that would have been great on YouTube, and there's
no
reason to just give it away.
I see what you're saying. That could bring in some serious coin.
I mean – at a minimum, you could repay for the body work on a car.
You free market types are always trying to think about how to make a buck. I like that. Kobe, nice job filling in for Liam.
Thank you.
All right. Jen, thank you as always. And nice job with the pig sounds. That is all the time we have for this week. The
were those pig
sounds?
What were they, Jen?
What was that?
Donkey sound.
Oh, that was a donkey. That was a jackass.
Donkey. Oh! Mike, she's calling you a jackass.
She knows that sound was for you.
Oh. Oh! Dude!
I thought that you were only being called a pig. But I clearly need to brush up on my barnyard animals. Okay, that is seriously all the time we have for this week. Check out the original Education Gadfly at edexcellence.net. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.